Hey everyone,
Set it up.
welcome to this 90-second webinar on the Secret Doctrine. So as you know by now, this webinar series is available on mercara.us under the subheadings Moray Federation Webinars and Webinar Series in Progress. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and a Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can access any of these webinars on the homepage of MorayFederation.com in the upper left-hand corner. In case you've lost your invitation or you didn't get it, like I think today there wasn't one sent out.
Yes, there was.
Was there?
Yeah, came out this morning.
Oh, good, good. All right, so this month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott attempts to retire from being president of the Theosophical Society, and it caused a firestorm. Can we get a reader, please?
Sure, I'll start off.
Great.
Meanwhile, before leaving home for Ceylon, I had written to HPB my intention to retire from the presidentship and to give her the entire executive as well as spiritual management, which she seemed anxious to acquire. I reminded her that our pioneering work was practically finished, and she could easily find half a dozen better educated and more yielding men than myself to help her continue the movement. My intention was also communicated to a number of our leading men, both of the East and West. I was so much in earnest that I wrote to Buddha Kamand to ascertain what was the best season for me to begin building cottage, which I intended for my old age retreat, and where this very chapter is being written. Protests came pouring in from all sides, and a number of my correspondents announced that they should leave the society unless I consented to remain.
Thanks, BL. So, second reader, please.
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. HBB cabled nightly that she would not allow him to read to the convention a friendly farewell address to myself, which he had drafted and sent her a copy of her approval. She said that the masters disapproved of my resignation, and by the next mail she wrote him a positive order to return at once if I should retire, threatening herself to withdraw and dismember the TS, the Theosophical Society. By the next week's mail, which reached me on the last day of the year, she offered to make any sacrifice to keep me in office, as in any case the ruin of the society was prophesied by so many of my most valued friends. I consented to continue in office for the present, and my announcement of this decision provoked a storm of applause at the convention when my annual address was read. In notifying HPB of my suspended resignation, I told her that my continuance in office would depend upon her readiness to alter the form of obligation which candidates of the ES were then talking. I don't know what ES is.
ES is it's the esoteric section of the Theosophical Society. Main point here was that they basically, here's, by the way, you can see Colonel Olcott here, and here's HPB's terrible resolution because the original wasn't that higher resolution, but yeah, they wouldn't let him retire. Yeah, I eventually did, but okay, we are currently exploring the first verse of the final stanza of Secret Doctrine, first volume of Secret Doctrine. And this verse outlines the seven celestial orders. You may remember we've been looking at those for a while now, ranked from highest to lowest. these correspond directly with to the seven manifested creative hierarchies. So we began our last session by taking a look at the all-important fourth and fifth orders, which correspond to the monadic and soul hierarchies. Quote, the fifth group is a very mysterious one, and it is connected with the microcosmic pentagon, the five-pointed star representing man. In India and Egypt, these dhyanis were connected with the crocodile, and their abode is in Capricornus. These are convertible terms in Indian astrology, as this 10th sign of the zodiac is called Makara, loosely translated crocodile. HPB then revisits the theme of the Egyptian afterlife, portraying the journey of the deceased as a transformative path toward union with his or her soul, symbolized by the crocodile, which esoterically represents the dragon, a symbol of the soul realm in many ancient civilizations. Quote, what is this? He is the dragon of wisdom, or Manas, the human soul, mind, the intelligent principle, called in our esoteric philosophy the fifth principle. HPB then cites this passage from the Book of the Dead. Here's the fifth. I am the fish of the great Horus. Sorry, guys, I'm trying to find what's going on here. Must have left out a slide or something. Anyway, I am the fish of the great Horus, as Makara is the crocodile, the vehicle of Varuna. I am merged in Sekhten. Sekhten, usually spelled Sekhem, is associated with the life force and thus with the potency of deities and pharaohs. We then explored the concept of the Egyptian heart, known as the Ib. I'm gonna have to go out and find where the heck, what's going on here. Okay. Which was believed to be the source of a person's thought. And we're talking about the Egyptian heart, which is called Ib. Source of a person's thought, memory, will, and moral conscience. In the Hall of Two Truths, it was this very heart that was weighed against the feather of Ma'at. For only a heart unburdened by guilt could pass the test. In the Book of the Dead, the defunct says, "Oh, my heart, my ancestral heart, necessary for my transformations. Do not separate thyself from me before the guardians of the scales." So, just don't know what's going on. So, once your heart passes the weighing of Ma'at, the deceased becomes Osirified, or transformed into an aspect of Osiris, which allows one to, quote unquote, harvest the fields of Anru, the theosophical Devachan, where the risen soul now dwells. And this pretty much takes us up to where we left off. Next up, let me go back into full mode here. Could we get a reader for this, please?
Marianne, can you read that for us, please?
Myself?
Yes, please.
Okay. The fifth group of the celestial beings is supposed to contain in itself the dual attributes of both the spiritual and physical aspects of the universe. The two poles, so to say, of Mahat, the universal intelligence, and the dual nature of man, the spiritual and the physical. Hence its number 5, multiplied and made into 10, connecting it with Makara, the 10th sign of zodiac. The sixth and seventh groups partake of the lower qualities of the quaternary. They are conscience, ethereal entities, as invisible as ether, which are shot out like the boughs of a tree from the first central group of the four, and shoot out in their turn numberless side groups, the lower of which are the nature spirits, or elementals of countless kinds and varieties. From the formless and unsubstantial, the ideal thoughts of their creators, down to the atomic, though to human perception, invisible organisms.
Okay, so first, the fifth group of the celestial beings is supposed to contain in itself the dual attributes of both the spiritual and physical aspects of the universe, the two poles, so to say, of Mahat, the universal intelligence, and the dual nature of man, the spiritual and the physical. So this perfectly describes the dual fifth hierarchy, about which DK says, "A clue to the mystery lies also in the relation of the fifth group to the two contracting poles. They are the fivefold links, the benign uniters, and the producers of at-one-ment." So think, all during this, think of soul and personality as the soul as the benign uniter of personality and soul, and the producers of at-one-ment. Esoterically, they are the saviors of the race. And from them emanates that principle which, in conjunction with the highest aspect, lifts the lower aspect up to heaven. So the highest aspect being the monad. In occult anatomy, the pentagram stands for the five-limbed thinking human. Manas, the fifth principle, the conscious self. Thus, Makara becomes the hieroglyph of Manas, the bridge between spirit, Atmabuddhi, and matter. Next. Hence, it's number 5, multiplied and made into 10, connecting it with Makara, the 10th sign of the zodiac. The pentagram is doubled because it represents the two aspects or poles of the fifth hierarchy, soul and personality. The seekers of satisfaction and the perfected ones. Seekers of satisfaction, of course, being the personality aspect and the perfected ones, the soul, represented by the down pointing and upturned pentagrams. Of course, the seekers of satisfaction. Well, you can read it really two ways, but the generally speaking, the down pointed pentagram represents the personality aspect because of its orientation, and the up pointing represents the lower quaternary, which are these four points now guided by the soul aspect, which is the upper point. So this symbol is thus related to Capricorn, the 10th sign, which, if you count these, has 10 main stars. Okay, so now we come to the end of this long section that we've been reading about on these seven celestial orders, and this is the last section, which reads here, from which the three, the five, and the seven. The commentary begins, quote, "The sixth and seventh groups partake of the lower qualities of the quaternary. They are conscious, ethereal entities, as invisible as ether." So the sixth and seventh groups are the lowest of the seven celestial orders and directly correspond to the sixth and seventh manifested hierarchies. Standing just above the seventh and using that hierarchy to build the forms of its own sixth hierarchy are the lunar lords, called also the greater builders, the sacrificial fires, the Barkhishad Pitris, and the lunar ancestors. They use the energy of matter, called Kundalini Shakti, and are ruled by sixth ray Mars, the hierarchical ruler of Sagittarius, whose astral quality is symbolized by the color red, and whose field of expression is the sacral center. They, quote unquote, ooze out their astral doubles, which become the models for human physical forms. The goal and eventual destiny of these lives is the personality life of a human being. So, though they're called greater builders, that's only in relation to the elemental lives which they use to build the sheaths, the personality sheaths. An old commentary says of them, "The devas hear the word go forth. They sacrifice themselves, and out of their own substance, they build the forms desired. They draw life and the material from themselves and yield themselves to the divine impulse." The sixth hierarchy use the energy of matter to create the three personality sheaths, which through progressive initiations are gradually brought under the control of the solar aspect by means of the personality ray. Because these lesser Pitris, the groups that make up the sixth hierarchy, are devoid of self-awareness, they progress unconsciously with the tide of evolution. In the seventh hierarchy, we find the lesser builders who determine the archetypal patterns through which the forms of the etheric physical plane are produced. These include those elemental lives that make up the positive pole of the energy found at the heart of every atom. The secret doctrine calls these lives terrestrial spirits, which configure themselves under the direction of the sixth hierarchy in such a way that they actually form, their little bodies form the etheric physical bodies. These lesser lives inform the physical atoms of substance, and because they are sentient or living, they are subject to the laws of karma. Imbued with the most material aspect of the seventh ray, which is represented by the color violet, this hierarchy's ruler is the moon, whose work in relation to humanity is to form what is sometimes called the prison of the soul, creating, in response to karmic law, the body types and the qualities of energy through which the indwelling jiva works to effect its own liberation. But it does this blindly, following the dictates of the lunar lords of the sixth hierarchy above it. for whom they are the quote, baskets of nourishment, a name given this hierarchy because they are the living substance of the physical etheric plane. Okay, if you have any questions or thoughts anytime along the way, just speak up, raise your hand. Okay, next, which are shot out, I'll read a little more of this. They are the conscious ethereal entities as invisible as ether, which are shot out like the boughs of a tree from the first central group of the four and shoot out in their turn numberless side groups, the lower of which are the nature spirits or elementals of countless kinds and varieties. So it is the sixth and seventh hierarchies that are quote unquote shot out. HPB here uses the metaphor of a sacred tree whose trunk is the quote central group of four. This refers to the four highest manifested hierarchies whose intent and direction results in the first group of offshoots. This first group, which represents the highest builders of the sixth hierarchy, is made up of the ideal formless entities who embody the thought forms that carry the directives from the higher four. So they coordinate these higher directives. From this thought form bearing group then manifests the countless layers of nature spirits and elementals that make up the two lowest hierarchies and who at the lowest levels are atomic elementals, invisible spirits of atoms that underlie every particle of physical substance. Next, from the formless and unsubstantial, the ideal thoughts of their creators, down to the atomic, though to human perception, invisible organisms. So the formless and unsubstantial ideal thoughts are archetypal projections from the quote, central group of four that act as blueprints for the builders to create the substantive lower quaternary. Any thoughts, questions, comments? Okay. Next up, can we get a reader, please?
Janet, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The latter are considered as the spirits of atoms, for they are the first remove backwards from the physical atom, sentient, if not intelligent creatures. They are all subject to karma and have to work it out through every cycle. For as the doctrine teaches, there are no such privileged beings in the universe, whether in our or in other systems, in the outer or the inner worlds, as the angels of the Western religion and the Judean. A Dian Shohan has to become one. He cannot be born or appear suddenly on the plane of life as a full-blown angel. The celestial hierarchy of the present Manvantara will find itself transferred in the next cycle of life into higher spiritual worlds and will make room for a new hierarchy composed of the elect ones of our mankind. Being is an endless cycle within the one absolute eternity, wherein move numberless inner cycles, finite and conditioned. Gods, created as such, but evince no personal merit in being gods. Such a class of beings, perfect only by the virtue of the special immaculate nature inherent in them, in the face of suffering and struggling humanity, and even of the lower creation, would be the symbol of the eternal injustice, quite satanic in character, and ever-present crime.
Okay, so let's unpack this. First, the latter are considered as the spirits of atoms, for they are the first removed backwards from the physical atom, sentient, if not intelligent, creatures. They are all subject to karma and have to work it out through every cycle. So the spirits and spirits of atoms are those members of the elemental kingdom, shown here, that inform atoms of substance. They are alive, but of course have no spark of mind, which suggests that the karma that they are subject to is not individual karma. It's not retributive karma, and thus impacts them only indirectly in accordance with the nature of the forms of which they are part, right? This kind of karma is the kind that governs the evolution of the form aspect during a given cycle. Next. For as the doctrine teaches, there are no such privileged beings in the universe, whether in our or in other systems, in the outer or the inner worlds, as the angels of the Western religion and the Judean. Meaning that all sentient beings, whether an angel or elemental, who demonstrates its tiny life through an atom of substance, all are subject to karma, the primary means for growth. And it, certainly in our solar system, and since the lords of karma come from Sirius, it's probably a universal system. The footnote, referenced by the phrase inner world, states, a world, when called a higher world, is not higher by reason of its location, but because it is superior in quality or essence. Yet such a world is generally understood by the profane as quote unquote heaven and located above their heads, right? Straightforward enough. Theosophy often uses the term inner to express superior in quality or essence or vibration. Next, a Dian Chohan has to become one. He cannot be born or appear suddenly on the plane of life as a full-blown angel. The celestial hierarchy of the present Manvantara will find itself transferred in the next cycle of life into higher superior worlds and will make room for a new hierarchy composed of the elect ones of our mankind. So this is a very important teaching, a fundamental tenet and a fundamental tenet of theosophy. No being, God or otherwise, springs into being from nothing. Over countless Manvantaras, all sentient beings progress from atoms of substance up through the lower kingdoms of nature to become eventually human beings, then solar beings, and beyond. During each cycle, the life wave inhabits progressively higher forms in keeping with the developing consciousness. And the elect of a previous cycle make up the hierarchies of the new cycle. Next. Being is an endless cycle within the one absolute eternity, wherein move numberless inner cycles, finite and conditioned. So I'll finish this and then get to you, Ariane. Each word in the phrase one absolute eternity, right here, implies the inclusion of all manifested universes, past, present, and those potentially coexisting within our current multiverse. These represent an infinite continuum of expressions of the one absolute eternity, which generates the form aspect through which beingness evolves across endless cycles of becoming. Okay, BL, could you call on?
Yeah, Ariane, please go ahead. And Francis, I want to tell you my internet is winking in and out. So if you lose me or I don't respond right away, that could be it.
Okay, good to know. Thanks. Go ahead, Ariane.
Yeah, I just wondered if we could talk about the Devic beings a little bit, because I think they're like sensing beings. Is it the Lunar Lords that create the different animals and plant species and not the Devic beings? And then why don't we have new ones on this planet as we unfortunately are destroying many species now? So that's the first question. And the second question is, I know there's also Devic entities that make up the infinitesimally small aspects of one's body. Could you talk about that as well? So those are, I know Deva is used in about many things. I'm just wondering if you could help orient us a little bit better.
Yeah, so, you know, at its highest level, the Dhyani Chohans are these great conscious beings that are the creative forces of our universe. These are solar entities, but they still work with the third aspect in that they are creators, right? Brahma itself is this creative force. And these exist on every subplane of the cosmic physical plane. They are the David lords of each plane, have a host of beings who generate the substance of that plane and the being who exists thereon. You know, when you get into the lower quaternary, then those beings, those Devic beings, are lunar, meaning just simply that they are oriented towards the building of the material sheaths of the inhabiting of the jivas who will inhabit them, right? And they're at all grades, and that's indicated by the creative hierarchies. So the lowest two creative hierarchies at sixth and seventh in are those lesser devas who are lunar beings and who use the elementals, who are also part of the Devic kingdom, to in the creating of the forms, and that includes starting with the human going downwards, all the lesser kingdoms in nature, animal, man, animal, plant, and mineral kingdoms are all built by these. The form aspect is built by these lunar Devic beings, compared to their, or in contrast to the higher Devic lords who are solar in nature and are self-conscious, and some of them as great as masters of wisdom. So it's a parallel group. You have the humanity and you have the devas who work together. At a certain point at the sixth initiation, you have what's called the divine marriage. In the divine hermaphrodite, you actually merge with the Devic kingdom. So it's two aspects that eventually become one. And okay, there was a second question there. What was that? Or did that?
I think you merged them, but it was, the first question was about if the solar lords, the Devic beings, are creating species, how come we're not getting new species you know, obviously new species on this planet. You're saying that the lunar Devic beings are the ones that the body is comprised of, right? That they're the smaller ones. They're just the sensate ones. They're not per se creative. But the solar entities are, and they're devas. I'm just wondering why we don't see more new life forms. Yeah.
Well, it's because we're in the fourth, we're just past the midway point in our cycle of becoming. We're in the fifth root race. And so the that time of diversity, which happens during the first half of a globe, through the first four cycles of a globe, and those cycles are measured by root races, because of course it's centered around humankind. But you know, even if it was centered around another kingdom, we are halfway through a globe. And at that halfway point, there is a return from diversity back to singularity, there's a collectivism that takes hold of the consciousness of that on the return path. And this is true of species as well. So you have greater diversification of species in the first 3 and a half of the fourth globe, and then you move on to the evolutionary cycle, and outer diversity is replaced by this inner reabsorption. By the end, by the next globe, there literally won't be any physical or earthy plane substance. Our next globe will have that as its primary element, water, though that water won't be anything like our water. It'll just be, the densest will be quite a bit less dense than it is at the fourth globe. Okay.
So you're saying that we're progressing to the more the planets where they just have etheric life. They don't have any physical expression of that life. And
eventually, I mean, we have a long, millions of years to go. Still within this entire globe will manifest physically. You know, even the root races, the remaining. Let's see, five, we're on the fifth, so the rest of this root race and the sixth and seventh will still have physical counterparts, right? But the overall trend is sublimation, or moving out of the dense physical, including, that includes diversification. Of course, my guess is that they're, that at the beginning of a root race, that there would possibly, it's just my thinking, there could be possibly a change in the nature of certain species, because everything is affected by this upward shift in energy.
And when you say globe, about how many millions of years is that? And is that like the incarnational cycle of this planet, like the moon with the previous incarnational cycle? And why wasn't the moon removed? Like, why did it stay in the sky? Will our Earth remain as a physical
planet in the next one? It eventually, the moon is decaying and it will gradually disappear. It has to do with the karma of the previous chain, of which our moon is a vestige. That chain was interrupted in its development. It didn't go through the entire process. And so what happens is, from one chain to the next, there is a transference of the life ways from the first planet of the previous chain to the first planet of this chain, the second to the second, third to the third. And then the moon, which was the the fourth planet of the previous chain, called the Moon Chain, that life wave was transferred to the Earth, right? And that's why the Moon is now, in DK's words, a totally dead planet with no vibration of its own, right? So as to why it's in the sky, it's in part because the previous chain did not fulfill its complete destiny, and therefore there wasn't time for that globe D of that chain to completely dissolve and dissipate. And that's still in process, right?
So this is not the Moon is not a previous incarnation of the Earth, and it is just truncated. It's a planet that didn't evolve to its maximum, and so it's just
it is the previous globe D of the previous chain called the Moon Chain. So it occupied the same space, or it was the fourth in line, just as our Earth was the fourth in line of this, is the fourth in line in this chain, right?
So was it a different logoic being that inhabited the Earth, or is it the same?
Yeah, well, Sanat Kumara is only the logos for this globe. So every globe has its own logos. And so it's an office. You know, there's this great being who is Sanat Kumara, and he holds the office of planetary logos. And this is a very pivotal one, because it is during this globe that the solar angels, through Venus, have come to overshadow humanity. And as a result of that, we have this Venusian influenced logos, who is Sanat Kumara. He came to us via the second, not only the second globe, which is the Venus globe, but the second chain, which is the Venus chain. So there's a direct connection with Venus in the way Sanat Kumara came to our globe to assume the office of the planetary logos. In the next globe, which will be the Mercury globe, we'll have a new logos at that time for the evolution of that globe, which will be an unimaginably higher spiral of the of human evolution.
And so what happened to the logoic being that was embodying the Moon?
Well, that's a good question. That particular logos, you have the being and you have the logos himself. And, you know, we're not given this information, you know, where that logos went after that, you know. It's not our logos, because uniquely, Sanat Kumara, the advent of Sanat Kumara's rule on this globe is traced for us. You know, DK tells us that it came, that he first appeared on the second chain, and then from there went to the second, to the Venus globe of the fourth chain, and from there to this globe of the fourth chain. That's how he got here. But normally we have no information about these logoi or who they are or what they did, because they represent, I mean, it's billions of years, really, in the past, you know, that you would be looking at the influence of these beings. So, yeah. Okay. Thanks, Ariane.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Barbara's got her hand up.
Go ahead,
great. Barbara.
Barbara,
go ahead.
Yes, I have a question about the relationship of the Diana Chohans, David Chans, and Manasa Putras. So if one is concerned with form and actually issues form from its own being, How does it get a mind?
Yeah, well, that comes to the Manasaputs. It's a different class of beings that do this. You could say it's a different class of Devic beings. These are the Manasaputras. So first of all, you have these high architects, which are part of the, you could say, the Brahmic host, the host of Brahma, the Prajapatis, and they're concerned, they're great solar beings, but their province is designing and providing the blueprint for the coming humanity, for that chain, and for each globe, right? So the appropriate vehicles, the blueprints for the appropriate vehicles for them. These are great high beings. This is picked up by the Devralords of the lower quaternary, and you could say that, you know, these hosts of devas then take over the actual creative building process, right? Some of those devas, the highest devas, are self-conscious. Then the lesser devas, which make up the sixth and seventh hierarchies, are not, but they are great forces, building forces, called the greater builders. And then they use the seventh to actually create the forms. Then you have this whole other class, which are the Manasaputras, and they're the solar angels, you know, with the emphasis on solar, because the difference, one difference between lunar and solar, is the mental aspect, which is the fire aspect and is conditioned by solar consciousness. So these great beings take the animal man that has been created during the first 2.5 root races and has finally been formed into a vehicle refined enough to receive mind. And then they overshadow those animal men, and plant the spark of mind. And in Blavatsky tradition, they literally, in the third root race, incarnated through these animal men, and in that way conditioned and planted the spark of mind. This is the myth of this has to do with Lucifer and the fallen angels, right? And so, but also that whole body of Manasaputras, who are solar angels, who are our souls, are this solar group of devas, as opposed to the two other groups, the very high Dhyani Chohans, who design and issue forth the what could be called the blueprint, the appropriate blueprint for that particular cycle, and then the building angels themselves. Does that help clarify
Yeah,
a bit?
thank you. Yes, yeah, so it's a process of overshadowing then that brings the spark of mind into.
Yes, right. Before that, it's there, the process is one of projection. In other words, the higher beings who are working to perfect the form during the first 2.5 root races, well, up to the middle of the early third root race, they literally project the forms into a lower plane of matter. So from a higher to a lower, and they're direct copies, projected copies. They're called chahayas, chahayas. And these are, of course, mindless, because the whole process in those early times is simply to create finally, and it takes a long time, a vehicle that is capable of successfully housing the spark of mind.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Okay. Anyone else? All right. So, being is an endless cycle within the one absolute eternity, wherein move numberless inner cycles, finite and conditioned. That's a really important sentence. Being itself, out of being out of time and space, is inherently endless. Its cycle, it's, let's see. When you're in the reference of beingness, or really more appropriately, be-ness, then it's an endless cycle. It's, you could say, it includes the entire universal manifestation. And it exists within the one absolute eternity, wherein move numberless inner cycles. And it's those inner cycles that become finite and conditioned, you see. So it's the wheels within wheels, and the lesser wheels are finite and conditioned. So this could describe, at any level of life expression, it can describe, solo-logoic expressions, and it can planetary or expressions within those kingdoms upon a planet. Yes, Tom, I see. Sorry, Bill.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does this also mean that the whole manifestation is finite and conditioned because it is a manifestation?
Yeah,
It's itself.
becomes
It's
radical.
finite.
Yes, it's, there, you have what HPB calls the absolute, unconditioned reality, called the one life, which has no form aspect whatsoever, and it mirrors itself. You can see this in the Vesca Pisces, the idea of the circle on the left. If you can visualize a Vesca Pisces, being this absolute source which mirrors itself in that intersecting circle on the right, which is Mula Prakriti, or the pure shining sea of substance, completely undifferentiated. And then the central section, which is that kind of almond-shaped section, is where the two meet. Fohat, that electrical force, brings, or you could say, brings together spirit and matter, and imprisons, you could say, spirit in matter. And those are the countless myriads of sentient beings from low to high. Part of that mirroring is what's called the first logos. Is, from our perspective, in every way, completely formless, right? With absolutely no form aspect at all. However, it is a first logos that is not the absolute, except for it is, of course, one with it. But in ex it, you could say it's its representative in universal expression, right? And then the second logos is that sea of shining substance. The third brings it together, and manifestation begins. The whole first section of the secret doctrine, so probably the first 40 webinars, just deal with this, that, that reality, right? But you're absolutely right, Tom, that anything that exists in this universe is manifest, right? Only the absolute remains unmanifest, but the inner spark, the life aspect, exists at the central core of all manifest beings, whether the first logos of the entire universe or particle of substance. Anyone else? So here you have, you know, in this sentence, you have a kind of infinite continuum of expressions of the one absolute eternity, right? Yeah, and mysteriously, the middle principle is consciousness, and it's that aspect which is evolving across endless cycles of becoming, because beingness does not evolve, you know. It's the pure life aspect that just is, that stands at the center. It's pure spirit. But the connection between matter and this absolute spark of life, which is consciousness, that does evolve. And evidently, you know, from universe to universe, certainly it evolves over the multiple lives of, for instance, a solar logos, with the last life of a solar logos oriented towards the spirit aspect, and therefore towards the sublimation of all that occurred during all the lives of that solar logos, right? Okay, next up. Gods created as such would evince no personal merit in being gods. It's a very strange little diversion. She goes on, such a class of beings, perfect only by virtue of the special immaculate nature. Now remember, none of this actually happens. This is just a projection she's describing. Inherent in them, in the face of suffering and struggling humanity, and even of the lower creation, would be the symbol of an eternal injustice, quite satanic in character, an ever-present crime. So HPB is giving us a kind of what-if scenario that underscores the natural justice and the laws of karma that govern the path of becoming. You know, nothing can just suddenly appear as a god. And if that were to happen, it would be the symbol of an eternal injustice, right? Because we all work to get where we are. Yes, Nadell.
Didn't we learn sort of early on back, and I went back to the beginning of the secret doctrine things, going back to the beginning there, and I thought that what was said in the first few webinars was that you did have beings who emerged out of the absolute as gods. This seems to be saying that couldn't happen, unless I'm misunderstanding.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Okay, my take on that is that there are multiple instances. In fact, she tells us this, that there's multiple instances of universal manifestation, and these logoi who initiate the process would have worked themselves up to that point in previous universal manifestations. That's my take. Because ahead.
But what, as I recall, you had the absolute, and then there was, I've forgotten the names, but there were names of beings. that seemed to have, like the absolute could not create, because to create you have to sort of be manifest of some in some sense, and so out of the absolute we had emerged existences, if you will, that then created the gods, but that it was something had to come out of the absolute itself, yeah, without having to evolve into becoming that.
Well, within this one cycle, it would seem, that would seem to be the case, right? I mean, we could say the same thing about our solar logos, you know, if you just circumscribe our understanding and recognition to this solar system, then the solar logos just is, right? But obviously that great being evolved to become a solar logos. And I would say that this is just an infinitely higher arc, octave of that reality, that even these great beings who seem to come from nothing had experience in previous Maha Manvantaras, right? You know, because remember the first verse of the first stanza says something like, you know, that this being had slept for seven eternities, right? Mm-hmm. And then it shows the gradual awakening, you know, all the things they talk about, all the things that were not, that did not exist, right? You know, and then finally you have the three falling into four. Well, these initiating beings, which are the first three logoi, well, it's really the from the first comes the second, and from the second comes the third, are great beings. And though it's not traced, we can assume that they had previous existence. I'll just say that the natural logical extension of what we're being taught now if we extend that even to universal incarnations, it would hold that these logoi were not created out of nothing, but in fact evolved to that level in previous universes, previous manifestations of universal reality, right? Now, you know, that's not based on what I've read in the Secret Doctrine. That's just an extension, logical extension of what she says earlier and what we're being taught now.
I guess I would end up with, this would go so far back into time, which doesn't exist anyway, that it kind of doesn't make it can't make sense, I suppose.
No, it can't make sense because our sense is based on time.
Right, exactly.
And especially linearity. But, you know, you can kind of see at the end of it all, we return to the absolute and merge into that. This is even true in all pralayas. In other words, it's not just absolute pralaya, but you know, planetary pralaya, for instance, like the times between two chains, for instance. There's this gray pralaya of billions of years where all merges back into spirit, right? But there is a but the delineations of individual and group configuration is it's dormant, but it's held, so that in the new cycle those beings go forward once again. And that can be, for instance, the life wave of a whole new humanity that has been held in situ during pralaya and then once again goes forth. And something has been added during pralaya, which is what characterizes it or allows it to express the new cycle. Like say when you go to the fourth cycle to the fifth cycle, well, it's an entirely new energy, and that is infused during pralaya so that the life wave going out at the beginning of, for instance, the fifth cycle it has its roots from the previous, but it's expressive of a whole new vibratory field, right? So I think you could extend that to universal pralayas and universal recreations. Because otherwise, what would, see, the absolute is undifferentiated, completely undifferentiated. So what in it would give, for instance, the first, I'm kind of turning the question back on you, aren't I? What in it would give that first logos, for instance, the capacity to be the initiating creator for that entire universal reality? What, you know, this is some extraordinary being. Well, how did that being come into being? If it was issued forth from the absolute, you see what I'm saying? It's like if it really just is a pure spirit, undifferentiated in every way, how can diversification, which would be required for there to be a singularity, how could that issue forth from it? You know, it's more about the questions than the answers, because, you know, obviously we don't have the answers. So, you know, formulating questions that might take us closer to understanding is probably the best we can do.
Yep. Thanks.
Yeah.
Francis.
Yeah.
First off, Tom has his hand up in just a minute, Tom. I want to say, and I'll put it in the chat, your discussion right now reminds me of the Seeds of the Infinite webinars that
Michael
Robbins did. And so I'll put the link in there, but it all circles around that same thing over and over again, you know. Time is not, you know, the whole thing. So, yeah, there's hours and hours and hours of discussion on that. And it was a favorite topic of Michael Robbins. So go ahead, please, Tom. And then Janet, we'll get to you.
Yeah, I love this because this is the ultimate question that nobody can answer. And it's kind of, that it's the nature of reality, that it has never started and it will never end. So it's like the cosmic breath. And of course, it's logical that there are always more evolved beings around, because it never started and it will never end.
Which itself is not some, you know, you can say those words, but you can't actually participate in the, in that reality. You know, you can't participate in the reality that it never started. You know, how are you going to do that? You can't participate in the reality that it will never end, because that's just not, you know, we're event-based beings, right, that have a beginning and an end. So, yeah, that's a good point. Thanks, Tom. Anyone else? I see. Anything in the chat we should be looking at right now?
I was going to say, I'm sensing and seeing how we spiral through the universe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go up a notch and we're circling and we're moving and we keep as part of what we're describing here. If you kind of put it into that symbol of, a corkscrew and moving and up.
Yes.
And that. So that's, yeah. I just wanted to add that as a visual.
Thanks, Janet. Yeah, DK actually tells us that spiralic motion is the nature of movement in our current solar system, right? Which is a dual response. First to rotary motion, which is the movement of the form aspect, which is endlessly repetitive of cycles, and then to the pure spirit, motion of pure spirit, which is called direct motion, which doesn't spiral at all, but simply moves continuously and directly. The combination of those two then becomes spiralic. So we find ourselves revisiting a previous condition, but on a higher turn of the spiral, right? And that is the ruling motion for this second solar system. Yes, a hand?
Ariane here, yes. A couple questions, comments. So basically, when we take up whatever we were before we were this, some kind of something, speck, I don't know what it was, because we were not, we had no physical or etheric being. And then the transformational process is the suffering part of it. So that when we transform the suffering, when we go and relinquish the form aspect, something is absolutely different in the universe, I guess. Is that the short, is that part of what this is? And then I have a question.
Yeah, well, there's two things there, which is that, just from the logical perspective, you could say that every sentient being who will participate in the evolutionary cycle was present at the beginning, maybe no more than an atom of substance or whatever the very lowest informed jiva could be, whatever that is. That, in other words, it seems to me that during the universal unfoldment, that you couldn't have new jivas simply pop into existence, right? That we would have all had to be here initially. But then, so that makes the entire universal evolution just that, a process of becoming, which moves us from grains of sand and even less all the way up through all the kingdoms in nature. And then when we enter the human kingdom, you enter this realm of suffering, and that suffering comes from our dual nature, which is the play, the interaction, the interplay between soul and personality, and the evolutional process that is then taken on. And then when you become a soul infused personality, you transcend the personality reality, you move onto the Buddhic plane, and you start responding directly to your monad, and you leave suffering as human beings experience it behind, but your evolution is still there are levels of evolution that still remain for you to move through.
Well, wouldn't it be a different kind of challenge or suffering? And then I have a couple questions from what you remarked on.
Okay, I don't think it would be. First of all, there's only three planets, I believe, is it, or is it two, that where suffering as we understand it is experienced in the solar system. One of them is
Saturn.
It's three. It's Mars, Saturn, and the Earth, I think, which are.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So those are the only planets on which suffering as we know it is the process, is used as the process of becoming. You know, so obviously there are other ways to evolve. You know, for instance, the Devic kingdoms don't evolve through suffering.
Oh, that's incredible. So in terms of our beingness, so we're not created out of Sanakumara in any way. We pre-existed. What is our association with Sanakumara that we're here evolving on this planet?
Well, next time I see him, I'll ask. But it's certainly karmic, you know. These jivas embedded in form that we are associated with this planet. Why that is true is not a question I could answer, except for that and DK talks, he insinuates that there's planet hopping as well, you know, that we could have, for instance, come up through the mineral kingdom on another planet and then moved to this planet at a certain point, or that as we move into the fifth kingdom, we might transfer to another planet, that there is, that is one of the aspects of this. And this is, he talks about, you know, you are actually more oriented to your ray makeup than you are to the planet that you belong. For instance, if you are a seventh ray essential being, that you will be ultimately relating to, well, in our solar system, that would be Uranus as the seventh ray lord, you know. But how that works, how, you know, he doesn't elaborate on that too much. But he does give these insinuations that when you come up into higher levels of awareness, that avenues of opportunity connected with the other planets in the solar system open for you, you know.
Alex, one last question. So that's fascinating, these few remarks you've made. So these other planets in the solar system that have different ray structures, and they're affecting the beings on this planet, are they affecting Sanakumara as well? And then is their effect always beneficent? Because it's it seems like wars and such things, that these are mass events that are partially created from the difficult energies from the planets, and sometimes they say, well, those planets, they're in conjunction, but they don't really get along, or they're sort of afflicted, or they have difficulty in that constellation with its energy. So I'm just wondering, is this like pre-designed, that this is the way, it's almost like a mechanical effect of, for, you know, like a hothouse, you know, greenhouse, where we're undergoing these kind of massive influences. But are they influencing the planets also? Like, does Uranus influence Sanakumara?
Certainly. You know, first of all, Sanakumara is a cosmic being who is responding, who has liberated himself from the physical plane as a conditioning consciousness, but he expresses himself through this planet and thus through the seven planes of the physical plane. But his own consciousness is liberated from that physical plane consciousness, right? So there would be a great, really unimaginable for us, brotherhood among the Logoi of this solar system. You know, they are nodes and chakras in the body of the solar logos. You know, for instance, our The Earth has said, you know, three of the globes of our Earth work together at this point to be the root chakra of the solar logos at this time, because those roles change, you know. So the kind of interaction is on cosmic levels, rather than on the cosmic physical levels. That's not anything we can even possibly imagine, the nature of what that consciousness would be like. Now, in terms of you know, that part in the Great Invocation that says, you know, and may the plan be restored on Earth, that's the reason for the wars and the suffering it being extant, because we are in the, you know, the Kali Yuga, where the divine is not recognized in the consciousness of human expression. Of course, it is, but it's there is still the lower aspects in full expression. And so that's, you know, that's one of the, or you could say, a fundamental reason for that. There's also, at this point, an uprising of the Piscean energies as resistance to the transition into the Aquarian field of energies. And those Piscean energies are right now regressive, and therefore we find a number of people, you know, quite a number of people that are representative of those regressive Piscean energies.
So, are you implying that those Piscean energies out of which we're moving out of the constellation, which is related to individualization and of the human beingness, but also this identification with matter and traumatic enactments, are you saying that those are living energies basically that are resisting, revolting against the whole solar system, leaving it behind? And because I know, you know, I see the war going on between the different factions of humanity. There's a little war going on between the hierarchy and also the forces of greed, which are playing out now. But are you saying that that constellation, its energies are also rebelling against this progression of our solar system into Aquarius?
Not the energies on their own planes, but the energy as they are experienced by personality level consciousness at this time in our transition to the Aquarian age. So, you know, obviously all the planets compared to human consciousness are of an infinitely higher, even the non-sacred planets. The Logoi of Mars is an infinitely greater being, right? But the way the their energies are experienced by the personality aspect or the form aspect of humanity stimulates those personality traits. And part of that, you know, for instance, the negative or the shadow side of the Piscean energy field is experienced at this time by humanity as resistant to the unfolding Aquarian, the new unfolding Aquarian energies. Other segments of humanity are responding to those incoming energies rather than being resistant to them. And that's why you have this extraordinary duality, this division happening right now on the planet. So it's not the energies inherent on their own plane in these great constellations or planets, but rather how they are experienced. You know, every ray has a shadow side, and that shadow side is created through personality interaction with the ray types.
Well, I see. So you're talking about ray six, and yeah, that's really fascinating what you just said. It's not the energy itself, it's the way it's, you know, the conduit into the lower personality beings and its way of being lived out. That was a really interesting way of languaging it. I really appreciate that.
Good, good. Thank you, Arya. Well, we're just rolled through this session. You know, I love it because these conversations are what keep these webinars alive, you know, not how many pages we cover, right? But we still have a few minutes. So we just talked about this what if scenario. You know, if God's popped into being and that led to the discussion about, you know, well, then what's the nature of the very first logos who is, you know, mirrored into reality from the absolute? And so many questions came forth. Good stuff. So let's go ahead and read this.
Okay. Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. It is an anomaly and an impossibility in nature. Therefore, the four and the three have to incarnate as all other beings have. This sixth group, moreover, remains almost inseparable from man, who draws from it all but his highest and lowest principles, or his spirit and body. The five middle human principles being the very essence of those dhyanis. Alone, the divine ray, the Atman, proceeds directly from the One. When asked how can that be, how is it possible to conceive that those gods or angels can be at the same time their own emanations and their personal selves? Is it in the same sense in the material world, where the son is in one way his father, being his blood, the bone of his bone and the flesh of his flesh? To this, the teachers answer, verily it is so. But one has to go deep into the mystery of being before one can fully comprehend this truth.
So it's almost like, you know, this section is attempting to answer the discussion that I was having with Nadell, I believe, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay, so first up, it is an anomaly and an impossibility in nature. Therefore, the four and the three have to incarnate as all other beings have. So the it in it is an anomaly and an impossibility in nature references the idea of a quote sudden appearance of the plane of life as a full-blown god, right? So there are at least two ways to interpret the phrase the four and the three, both of which are described in the stanzas of John. The first comes from the idea expressed in verse 4 of stanza 2, quote, her heart had not yet opened for the one ray to enter, thence to fall, as three into four, into the lap of Maya. This verse references the incorporeal higher triad, which is the source of the lower quaternary. Another way to look at the four and the three comes from verse 7, of stanza 3, which happens to be my favorite verse in all the stanzas. Here we have the one as four rather than as three. One as four, which takes to itself three, suggesting the four supercosmic etheric planes taking to itself the lower three cosmic planes, as illustrated here, which also works at the level of the cosmic physical plane, where the four cosmic etheric planes, quote unquote, take to themselves the lower three subplanes of the cosmic physical plane. This latter is the model being used to describe the work of the sixth and seventh groups of hierarchies. Okay, that's where we'll stop. For this time, good discussion. I really enjoyed it. Let's see, you want to announce dates? I think this Friday
yes.
is the Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and otherwise.
Yes, the 22nd of August.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then the next Stoa is going to be a week early. It's going to be 31 August because we had to move it around a little. And then the next Secret Doctrine also had to be moved, and it's going to be the 28th of September.
So that sounds like a week late from
yes.
the fourth,
yes.
fourth Sunday. So, okay, so if you can't remember that, just, you know.
You'll get the announcements.
You'll get the announcements, and, you know, don't be shy about just going directly to moriafederation.com and looking on the calendar, too, when you're trying to design your schedule, you know. Okay, it sounds like that's it for this time. Thank you all for attending. And we'll just keep on keeping on. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.